Good evening. This is an interview for the Michigan Writers Series, Friday, September 14th, 2001. I'm talking this evening with poet Diane McCoskey, Michigan State University Distinguished Professor of English, and the winner of many prestigious grants and awards, including the 1989 William Carlos Williams Award from the Poetry Society of America. Welcome to the libraries, Professor McCoskey, and thank you for joining me tonight.
Well, thank you very much.
Now, I know that you're a California native, and for many years you lived and taught in New York City. Given that you have set your poems in a number of locales ranging from Los Angeles to Vienna, what do you think that living in Michigan has contributed to your writing? And after 25 years here, do you see yourself at all as a Midwesterner?
Well, I'll start with something you said. You lived and taught in New York. Well, yes and no. I taught junior high school for 2.5 years, which was like going to boot camp and learning about guerrilla warfare. And it taught me a lot about the world, not very much about what we would think of as education. Mm-hmm. I did occasionally teach a poetry writing, a poetry reading workshop at the New School. And at one point I did something very daring. I just put an ad in the New York Times and the Village Voice and said that I enlisted my publications and said I was give a workshop at the apartment where I lived. And got some interesting students, including one who's been a lifetime friend. But I wasn't really in the academic profession the way I am. And that's been the big difference of coming to MSU, is that for the first time in my life, I, who do not have any graduate degrees, and who began my poetry career saying there are three things I will never do. I will never do translations of poetry because people use them as something other than what they are. I will never write criticism, and I will never have a full-time job in a university, because I thought those were the ways that poets ask people to pay attention to them for non-aesthetic reasons. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, when I lived in New York City, I had crummy jobs that helped me pay my rent. And I was working at all times on being a poet, living a bohemian life with very little money, and trying to figure out how to become successful enough as a published writer that would actually give me enough money, and I didn't require a lot to avoid these other horrible part-time jobs, or full-time as the case may be, but part-time in my head certainly. And that's when I started doing what was probably the most important thing that I did in my life, which was trying to get money for giving poetry readings. And I think I'm one of the very, very first poets who made a kind of profession out of going around the country and giving poetry readings. The years that I did it, I never made more than probably $10,000 a year, but that was a lot of money for me. And I didn't have any rent. I stayed in other people's apartments. I didn't own a car. I went to college when it was affordable, so you didn't have to pay back thousands of dollars worth of loans. Mm-hmm. So I could live on what I earned. And I guess what's really different about being at Michigan State, besides the fact that it's the Midwest, and I never thought I'd wind up in the Midwest, either the West Coast or the East Coast were my worlds. The real difference is that I started living a bourgeois life. I became, for all practical purposes, an academic, mm-hmm. a person with a regular job, a pension. I'm very glad now that I have that, health insurance. It was a really, I didn't grow up that way. I didn't live my young life that way. I didn't become a poet that way. On the other hand, I was always a bookworm and a brain, and so being in the classroom was an easy thing for me to do. It was natural. I came to rest in my natural place without any of the artificial ways that people prepare to be there.
And you ended up doing at least two of the things that you said you'd never do.
Yes, alas, I did. I still don't translate poetry from a foreign language, but that was the only thing I was able to avoid.
Okay. Now, I'm very interested about the genesis of your work, the series of the archaeology of movies and books. I know that you're a film buff, but what else in your life led to this four-book series?
I began talking about the concept I call creating a personal mythology in the late 60s and started writing a little bit about it. See, I did start writing criticism in the 70s. And that made me much more aware of what I was doing in my own poetry to transform my autobiography into something that wasn't autobiography, a mythic story of an invented person named Diane. And again, in one of the things that I thought I wasn't going to do was get involved with classical mythology. Maybe I would find a way to use American mythology. Mm-hmm. But as you know, after inventing my various characters, including the King of Spain, who really comes out of fairy tales, I realized that one of the figures in myth whom I identified with since I was a sophomore in high school was Medea, the sorceress and woman who is the strange heroine of Euripides' play by that name. And I got more and more interested in this, and so I began to evolve a way to put Medea as an aspect of myself in my poems, as I'd been putting other figures in. And once I started doing that in a very conscious way, I decided I wanted to write an epic of the West told by a woman, and the voice would be a Medea-like voice. In other words, someone that we would consider a villain in our culture, because the only thing most people know about Medea is what is in Euripides' play, and that is that she murders her children. And most Americans have absolutely no understanding of why that happens. And even I, when I first started being interested in it, didn't have a very deep understanding of it. I just saw it as a response to the terrible betrayal and unfaithfulness of Jason. But it's far more than that. And so when I started creating the archaeology of movies and books, I thought, again, I loved the metaphor of archaeology from reading Charles Olson and his sense that epic poetry digs into the layers of civilization the way an archaeologist might and offers you up these shards that then present patterns and ideas that allow us to reconstruct whole cultures. So I thought, all right, I'm going to take my mythic Diane and let her be the storyteller of the culture. I also decided I wanted to write a book unlike one I had never ever written before, and my model was going to be William Carlos Williams Patterson, which uses collaged material from American history. Instead of American history, I, as you know because you've read the books, decided to collage in material from a layman's book on quantum physics, which seemed to me like part of the myth of our time, the way we make metaphors out of the whole history of human civilization that are based on images from quantum physics. And then I decided, because I've always loved the epistolary form, to put in letters to several of my sort of mythic poetry friends, in particular Craig Cotter and Jonathan Carroll, a poet and a fiction writer. And so those four books have a format of prose interspersed with poems and are an attempt to tell the mythic story of Diane, which has its parallels to the Medea story. And in some way, in telling the story, to arrive at some understanding of our culture as we've created in this country. I said that it was going to be open-ended, but I haven't for a while been working on the fifth book. I keep thinking about it. But I stopped working on the archaeology of movies and books to do a new and selected poems. And again, I've had a selected poems previously. That's the one that won the William Cross Williams Prize in the PSA. But what I wanted to do was something, and I begged my publisher to let me do it, and he finally did with lots of restrictions. I said, I really want to put together a book unlike one I've ever done before, which is totally thematic. And I want, because I feel like I've been so misunderstood by so many people, especially critics, even though I've had a very large reading audience, public, I want to put together a book that shows what my aesthetics are. And that's what my reading is going to be tonight. It's organized around the idea of a theme that runs through all my poetry from the very beginning of what is beauty, how do we define it, and in particular, how this has been a whole way of approaching the world for me and is, as I say, a theme in all my poems. And the subject matter, the theme being beauty, and the search for, the quest for beauty, the subject matter of the book is food, eating and drinking, and it starts from the very beginning. Butcher's Apron is a poem about my childhood and how I discover a sense of looking at beautiful food is like looking at a painting. And so that's what I worked on, and I'm now, instead of, again, working on a Greed Part 5, I'm working on another selected poems that does the same thing, only uses all the many, many poems I've written over the years with plants, particularly flowers, in them. And I don't know if my publisher will let me do that. One of the problems is, well, he wants me to keep Emerald Ice, which is the selected poems in print, and of course the four archaeologies, and so he feels dishonorable if you just cannibalize a book and leave nothing but three unrepublished poems in it. And so I promised him, he let me take 10 poems, 8 to 10, I can't remember, from Emerald Ice for The Butcher's Apron, and then a total of maybe 12 or 13 or 15 from the four archaeologies. And so I'll have to do the same thing. And I was looking through this today thinking, boy, there's so many poems I could have added to Butcher's Apron, but I just couldn't do it to be honorable and to fit my bargain with John. So I guess that means that eventually there has to be a second edition of The Butcher's Apron when we finally decide to collapse all those barriers and get everything into a in different format where I can add more poems.
Good. I hope that works out for you.
You can see I like series. I like
I
like stories. I like ongoing.
And certainly developing your personal mythology. I mean, I think you started working on that, as you said, in the 60s. We were about my age. I mean, you're mid-20s. And George Washington, father of my country.
Yes, my first.
You know, using the American mythology, certainly, and relating him to your own father and your relationship with him. But I a question about another early poem of yours, The Ice Eagle, and that first published in 64 in the aftermath of the Kennedy assassination at the height of the Civil Rights Movement. And I think it's a rather cynical poem about a cold and unfeeling America. And you are a very passionate writer. Passion, beauty, love, sex. I mean, those are very big themes in your work. They have been through all of your career. And I was wondering, do you still see America as passionless and unfeeling as you did then?
Well, I'm not entirely sure that I ever saw it as passionate and unfeeling. I think I saw it as perhaps passionate about things that, well, the values are askew. One of the ideas in that poem, the dominating image of the eagle is besides being the symbol for the American culture, is in archetypal terms a masculine image. And the trope in the poem is that the eagle has become an ice carving at a party for rich people, and this symbol of power and nobility and maleness in the Western tradition, all it can do is melt into the old punch. And that's not as much cynicism about our culture as cynicism about our misuse of traditional concepts of maleness and femaleness. And that I mean, the worst aspect of, say, the women's movement mm-hmm. is to break down, I mean, it's both a goodness and bad side, to break down the definitions of what it means to be a man or a woman, so that now there is no clear cultural role for anybody, male or female. And if we haven't exchanged anything, we haven't given up male nobility and the desire to rescue women and to take care of weak and poor things for women. Men have to be sensitive now, but mm-hmm. women, I mean, it's still a big issue to get a woman into the military, and if you get her into the military, she's not allowed to fight.
Yeah.
So we haven't, and I'm not suggesting that we should have traded male and female roles. That didn't solve any problem. I'm suggesting that we've always had a real misunderstanding of what the beautiful aspects mm-hmm. of maleness or the beautiful aspects of femaleness are. And maybe we live in a richer time now, and this is in response to your question. Maybe we live in a time where more is possible, but I don't know. I don't see any of our politicians, most of whom are male, being very heroic in any terms. I'm rereading the Tolkien trilogy because they've made
the films coming out, yes.
Of the first one of the trilogy is coming out this year, and thinking about the images of heroism and the different kinds of strengths. One of the, there aren't very many women in the any of the Tolkien mm-hmm. stories, but one of the most important people is the queen of the elves, Galadriel. And she has a magic that's as powerful as anything that Gandalf or any of the others have. And the power comes not by making her effete. She isn't a warrior. You know, one of my favorite books of recent years is Maxine Hong Kingston's The Woman Warrior. I think that's just an amazing book. And when she tells the mythic story of the woman warrior, I think she moves her prose up to the level of poetry, and it really is a powerful, powerful meditation on what's possible.
We really have just about a minute left, and I'm sorry to cut you off, and I really wish I could keep asking you questions much longer. But as a former student of yours, I'm especially interested to know what kind of literary legacy you would like to leave. And do you hope to be regarded someday in the light of, or in the same light, rather, as like Walt Whitman and William Carlos Williams, you know, who are two of your great influences? If you can,
well, I don't know that we can ever see what history will do for us. I would certainly like to be read and remembered in future centuries, assuming we have a civilization and have books. I mean, that's my first hope, is that we'll have a civilization and that we'll have books,
exactly.
And real books, not just virtual books.
Right.
And I would like to be read as an important poet of this part of, but I lived as part of a golden age of poetry in the 60s and the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if any of us are remembered, at least 100 or so will be remembered. I'd like to be among that company. And I'd like to be thought of as the poet who really introduced the idea of creating a personal mythology into common parlance. And as a poet who was absolutely unwilling to accept other people's aesthetics or definitions of beauty while still creating in that tradition herself.
Good. Would you quickly say then that you're a rebel? A pseudo-rebel?
Yeah, sometimes.
Okay.
Actually, I was going to say that in front of one of my readings. I definitely rebelled against my mother.
Most of us do, I think. Well, thank you very much, Diane, for participating in our writer series, for sitting through this interview, and I hope you enjoy doing your reading tonight.
Well, thank you so much, Stephanie. It's been fun.